I'm speaking today with Paul Sadler, who is running for the U.S. Senate in the Democratic primary. Paul, you were a member of the State House of Representatives. Let me ask you first, why are you running for U.S. Senate?
Because the people of Texas deserve a government that works, and the current government that we have is dysfunctional, and the candidates that are running in the Republican primary, particularly Governor Dewhurst, has not, in my opinion, done a good job in running our state. And so we deserve better, and we deserve to have a government that works. And so I know I can do that. My record is one of problem solving. I served in the legislature from 1991 to 2003. I worked bipartisan in a bipartisan fashion to pass education reform, property tax relief, health care insurance for teachers. I have been a problem solver and one that worked in a bipartisan fashion. And that's what we need in Washington right now. We need problem solvers that are more interested in what is good for the state of Texas and our country as a whole, rather than purely and instinctively only their party.
As you said, you were a member of the Texas legislature for 12 years. Tell me a bit about what you've been doing since then.
Well, I got out of the legislature in, effectively in 2001, when although my term didn't end until the end of 2002, when my youngest son was in a car accident. He was had a closed head injury and was in a coma for 4 days in the middle of the session. And we went through about 2 to 3 years of therapy. And so initially I worked every day, and then I worked with him, and my wife did. And, you know, Sam had a serious injury, and I'm thankful to say that he's made a complete recovery, but we went through a period of time that he had to learn to talk again and walk, and I spent quite a bit of time with him with those issues and practice law, quite frankly. And then in 2008, I decided to stop going into the courtroom and practicing law on a daily basis, and started working with a nonprofit, the Wynn Coalition, and I've been their acting executive director since 2008, in an 8-state region from Texas to Nebraska, including Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, etc., in charge of their government and regulatory policy, legislative and regulatory policy, and the development of commercial wind energy. So, that's what I've been doing until I announced December 19th.
Okay. So, well, since your professional experience recently has been in the area of wind energy, why don't you tell me how is Texas doing, and how is the United States doing in terms of its policies towards encouraging renewable energy like wind?
Texas leads the country in wind energy produced. It's not even close, really. We have approximately 11,000 megawatts of wind energy on the ground that's producing. We're in the process of building out what's called CREZ, which is the largest transmission build-out in North America. It's supposed to be completed by 2013, and at the completion of the CREZ transmission build-out, we will be able to handle up to 18,000 megawatts of wind energy. So we will continue to grow in wind energy. From a regulatory standpoint in Texas and ERCOT particularly, we're doing very well from a regulatory side. It is a very competitive business. It is a free market system. And it's a very active process, but I think from a regulatory standpoint, we're in pretty good shape as far as development of wind energy, as well as all forms of generation, frankly, but particularly wind energy. The United States ranks, I think, second in the world, largely because of Texas. I think we can do a better job, quite honestly, on a national basis. We have the ability in Texas to move real quickly because ERCOT is our principal grid and it's contained solely within the borders of Texas. And so we made some decisions decades ago that help us build out transmission faster, and we adopted a policy of open access to transmission, which was very helpful. On the national level, FERC needs to move faster. The FERC regulations for interconnection need to move much faster. I would like to see us have a more aggressive plan nationally in energy from top to bottom, but specifically in the build-out of the national grid, the opening up of the interconnects. Most people, the truth of the matter is that most people in this country know very little about how electricity is delivered to our home. We know it works, and we know it's relatively cheap, and that kind of suffices for us until it goes out. The fact of the matter is that the grid system as a whole doesn't communicate that well together, and we can do a much better job. So nationally, I think we have a long ways to go. Inside Texas, we're on the cutting edge. We really are on the cutting edge. The regions north of us and SPP are moving closer towards the ERCOT model, but it has a long ways to go as well.
Okay. Well, that's
a long-winded answer. Sorry.
All right, that's all right. Let's move from that to a different topic in energy. The Keystone XL pipeline, as you know, Republicans demanded an expedited answer from the Obama administration on this as a condition for, I don't even remember what particular budgetary item they held hostage a few months ago. The Obama administration came back and said, "We're not prepared to grant it a permit just now." He's come under some criticism, in particular from Texas, on that. What's your take on the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, thank you for asking that question. There's not very many people to ask, and you're exactly correct. Well, first, let me start with this premise. First, let me say that no one that owns a piece of property wants a pipeline to come through their property, nor do they want transmission lines to come through their property. No one does. But we all know that we have to have those items in order for us to grow as a society and grow as an economy. So I know there's great dissatisfaction with private property owners between here and Canada, and particularly in East Texas. I'm absolutely aware of those problems, and I'm not immune to them, and I don't close my ears to them. But let's talk about the Keystone issue for the pipeline precisely. You're exactly right. The Republican members of Congress, in the debate over the extension of the payroll tax extension, or the payroll tax, put into that bill, which had nothing to do with payroll tax extension, a arbitrary deadline of February 1st, for President Obama to decide whether or not it was in the best interest of our country to build a pipeline. Totally an arbitrary deadline. What most people have not reported on, and most people don't know, is that 2 weeks before that deadline, and I believe it was February 1st was the deadline, but 2 weeks before that deadline hit, the state of Nebraska was called into special session. Now, understand, the state of Nebraska has a unicameral legislature dominated by the Republican Party. It means it has one body. Everybody's a senator. They don't have a House and a Senate. They just have a Senate. They have a governor that's Republican Governor Heineman. I've met him. I know him. Very good man, very nice man, very pro-business. His wife is a former elementary school principal. Know her also. They called it into special session because the route through Nebraska had not been agreed to. So, and the reason it hadn't been agreed to is because the pipeline is originally laid out by TransCanada, cut across the regional aquifer there. That's their water supply, their fresh water supply. And they had great concerns over it in the state of Nebraska. So you have an arbitrary deadline placed on by the Republicans in Congress on President Obama, but you have a route cutting through the United States that has a big hole in it called the state of Nebraska. And their proposal was, y'all just start at both ends and we'll meet somewhere in Nebraska, which is totally unfair to people north and south of Nebraska. You kind of want to know where the route's going to go. This is a big pipeline.
All right.
It's important to know that the state of Nebraska, the day before President Obama said no on the permit, voted not to approve the route that TransCanada had proposed across the state of Nebraska. The Republican legislature in Nebraska said no. the bill and allocated $2 million to require an environmental impact study of the pipeline across their state. And that environmental study will take 10 to 12 months, which places you where? January 2013, which is exactly when the president originally proposed deciding the permit. So the confusion was planned, or the confusion was placed there by Republicans attaching a measure to a tax extension that did extension of a tax reduction that shouldn't have been there. And it was further confused by the act of the state of Nebraska and not approving the route, none of which had anything to do with President Obama.
Okay. I mean...
So what I think will happen is this. I think in listening to Governor Heinemann, they will approve a route somewhere through Nebraska. And it will approve sometime towards the end of the year. And then a permit will be requested again by Keystone, and a decision will be made as to whether or not that pipeline will be built. Now, for the state of Texas, there is benefit to the state as a whole of the pipeline. The benefit is it comes into our refineries, more jobs created and kept in our refineries, more domestic oil and gas production. We would much rather receive energy from our North American neighbors who are friendly than continuing reliance upon the Middle East. And so if we can meet the environmental impact requirements that we need to meet, if we can meet them, then I understand the need and the purpose of building the Keystone Pipeline.
Well, the environmental...
But we're not there yet.
Okay. I mean, the environmental impact is, of course, a big issue because it's tar sands, and it's kind of the dirtiest form of oil there is. I mean, what needs to be done to meet those needs, or can they be met, the environmental needs?
I honestly don't know if they can be met. But here's the fundamental underlying principle for the United States of America. Okay, every sitting president in my lifetime, and I'm 56 years old, as he left office, has said the same thing. We have got to end our dependence on foreign oil. Now, there are many ways that we can do that. And we get about 28%. And when they say foreign oil, they mean oil from the Middle East. We're okay with oil and gas we get from North America and our friends in Canada and Mexico. That doesn't bother us too much. But that roughly 28% we get from the Middle East creates a lack of independence and a security risk for this country. Now, we can do it a number of ways. We can conserve. We can go to alternative forms of energy, which we should do. The other is to take advantage of the production and the discoveries we find in North America. And, we'll just have to see if the environmental concerns can be met on this pipeline or not. But to suggest that right now the decision was made and is horrible for the United States and blame that on President Obama just simply is turning your head in that sand and not looking at this big hole in a route called Nebraska.
All right.
It's a huge route. And, I mean, that's a huge hole. And so let's let them get through their environmental study. Let's see what the route looks like. Then let's look at the environmental concerns and make a judgment at that time.
Okay. As we speak today, it'll be a little while before this interview is published, but as we speak today, President Obama has unveiled his budget for the next fiscal year. Give me your high-level overview of... the budget he's proposed. What do you like? What do you not like? What would you like to see more of?
Well, I like the fact that they increased funding to education, particularly in the areas of early childhood development. I haven't been able to get through the entire budget before I got on this phone into the interview, but I did see that portion of it, and they call for a substantial increase in funding to education. And so I think that's good. I think I'm like most Americans. We're concerned about the budget deficit. We're concerned about having a plan that truly does buy down our deficit and reduces it. I'm not sure how I feel about this budget. It's just too new to me, honestly, Charles. I haven't had a chance to get all the way through it. And as you know, and I think everyone else does, the devil's always in the details when it comes to this kind of thing. And it's a large large budget, and I naturally went to the education portion first because it's the part that I'm most familiar with, and I just didn't get through the rest of it.
Okay. Well, one of the themes that the president has been pushing lately is for more is to deal with economic inequality, to redistribute the tax burden a little more towards those with more money and away from those who have less. Put some of the burden on the financial district, Wall Street, to pay their fair share of what's been going on. What's your take on that?
Well, I assume that the highlights of the budget kind of reflect the State of the Union, where he talked about increasing the contribution to taxes by people. That's a nice way of saying pay more taxes by people that make over $250,000. And I also heard him describe having Wall Street pay for other programs. There's no question about the fact that we have problems with our tax code, and we have problems that when Mitt Romney pays 13% on his taxes, and someone making much less pays over 30%. I mean, there are serious problems within the tax code, and it does divide this country. I've dealt with a review of an entire tax code before. I chaired a select committee in Texas on revenue and public school funding and did a review of the entire tax system in Texas. And I can tell you that that's about as big a bloodbath as you'll ever go through. And you better dress in armor before you start it. So I don't think it's an issue that anyone relishes, but I think it's an issue that we've got to get control of, and we've got to spend some time on. It needs to be fair. And most people in this country, I think, have a feeling that the code is not fair. And where that, from a general standpoint, when that is the case and the public loses faith in the fairness of the tax system, we have huge problems. And so I look forward to reading what he's proposing and taking a look at it. I want to reserve my judgment, as you know, and as you just said, he just unveiled it this afternoon or today, and I just haven't had a chance to get through it. It's a big document.
All right. Immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform, has been a topic that's been kicked around for a long time now. You know, what does comprehensive immigration reform mean to you? What does it look like? What should it look like? What will you fight for in terms of comprehensive immigration reform?
Yeah, when you use the term comprehensive immigration reform, you better ask or better know who you're talking to in order to understand what it means. A couple of principles. Number one, there are a lot of people in this country that are living and working here safely as good residents, may not be citizens, but they're contributing to our society, they're raising their families here, and those people, I think we need to have a clear pathway, a reasonable clear pathway to citizenship. The very notion that we're going to somehow go out and round up everybody that's here, that's not here legally, and ship them back home is absurd, and we all know it is. And so I think it's important that we distinguish between those people that are here, that are working, they're contributing to our society, contributing to our economy, they're not committing crimes, they're wholesome families just like the rest of us, and we ought to have a way that they can become citizens in this country, that, you know, we're all immigrants in that sense, and we ought to have that. And today, I don't think we have a pathway that is reasonable in that regard. I think that we've got to get control of our border. I think I share the view that most Texans have, that the fear of the random and brutal violence that we see along the border. And I think the federal government's got to take a stronger role there, and we've got to be more committed to it. I'm not in favor of building a fence. I don't think that's a great idea. So I think the key is that we do everything we can, and we need to and must secure the border. And then secondly, we have to create a reasonable, clear pathway to people that are here working and raising families and contributing to our economy.
Okay. the signature achievement of the Obama administration, I'd say, in the first term, of course, was the Affordable Care Act. Of course, a lot of Republicans have been campaigning on the idea of repealing it. What's your opinion of the Affordable Care Act?
You know, I was in favor of it at the beginning, and I still am. I recognize that the mandate is controversial. A lot of people don't like the mandate. The mandate is before our court system, and I understand the arguments for and against the constitutionality of it. I think it'll be interesting to see how the Supreme Court rules. We should have an answer to that either this year or early next year. But outside of the mandate, the rest of that act is very good and has great public support. You know, I saw an interview just a week ago or so from two people, one's a doctor and one was involved in the hospital administration, said the only people that are complaining about the Affordable Health Care Act are the politicians. The people that are in the system recognize the efficiencies that are being generated and recognize that 2.5 million more Americans have insurance today than they did 2 years ago, and recognize that pre-existing condition coverage is a good thing for Americans, and that being able to keep your kids on your policy at age 26 is a good thing, and that it's only the politicos that seem to be running around and the guys on the radio that do that for a living that seem to be hollering and screaming most about the affordable health care. Those that are involved in implementing it and understanding it, I'm being told and are talking to me, I'm talking about my local doctors and my health care providers, they're saying that this bill, or this act on the whole, is a very good piece of legislation. So from the beginning, I supported it. I still do. I've had a son, as I mentioned earlier, that had serious injury. I know very well the issues concerning pre-existing condition. We had excellent insurance coverage, but I also know the problems with getting that coverage and getting the doctors paid and hospitals paid, et cetera, and the lack of efficiency in the system. And so I don't need someone to explain to me the problems. I understand them firsthand. So I supported from the beginning, and I continue to.
Okay. Just recently, again, last week as we're talking now, the Obama administration announced some new rules regarding providing insurance coverage for birth control for religious institutions. There were some revisions on that, but after some controversy, but the decision has been made and it's going forward. What is your opinion on the on the ruling that the Obama administration made on that?
I'm more comfortable with the second decision than I was the first. I recognize the separation of church and state, and I recognize the authority of the church in our spiritual lives and the devotion people have to their religious beliefs and teachings. And to the extent that they felt or believed, and it may have been true, that the federal government was impinging in that area of decision-making, I'm uncomfortable with that. I'm much more comfortable with the second proposal where he, his ruling, as I understand it, is that insurance companies will make direct assessment and payment to the employee as opposed to going through the employer. I'm much more comfortable with that. That puts it back on the back of an individual decision-making as we go through.
Okay. You know, as I'm sure every reporter will remind you when they talk to you, Texas hasn't elected a Democrat statewide since 1994. Why do you think this year is different?
It's about time, don't you think?
I sure do, but I'm not the person you have to convince of that.
look, there have been, you know, the funny thing is there have been 26 United States senators from Texas that were Democrats. There have only been 6 Republicans. There was one independent fellow by the name of Sam Houston. So the majority of by a huge margin, we've sent more Democrats to the United States Senate than we have Republicans. And it's only been in recent years that we've sent Republicans. The Texas Texas voter is a very independent group or individual, and that I believe that they will look at the two individuals that come out of the primary season, and the Democratic side and the Republican side, and decide for themselves in an independent fashion who best reflects their interests in the United States Senate. And it's not merely just reflecting your interest, it's who you trust. Who do you trust to make decisions and solve problems on your behalf? And I would maintain to people that if they simply look at the record over the last decade under Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, you will be appalled. You will be absolutely appalled that someone would think they deserve to be promoted to the United States Senate with that record. For example, in the last session, we just, with almost $8 billion left in the rainy day fund, they intentionally and purposefully cut public education by over $5 billion. That means larger class sizes for your children. That means teachers getting fired. And it only gets worse. The second half of the biennium, the cuts are deeper than the first half. And there are many school districts out there that are called Robin Hood districts that are sending almost 9 cents out of 10 cents of their local property taxes to the state already. Those districts are fixing to get cut by 8 to 9% more. That's a double whammy of a Robin Hood scheme. It was done by the Republican Lieutenant Governor, his Senate, and the House of Representatives, and signed by this governor, Republican governor. They've increased the number of Robin Hood districts. They have hurt our children and the education of our children. And for the very first time in the known history of this state, they did not even provide for the new kids into our system. That means the new kids coming into our public education system, they did not fund. That's appalling. That's absolutely appalling that they would not take care of our business better than that. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. We're facing the worst drought in the history of our state. We have no statewide policy for water, no statewide plan to deal with it. They failed to fund the last 4 months of our health care system. Almost $4 billion they left as an unsigned check sitting out there for the next legislature. Almost $4 billion they know when they come in 2013, they have to face a $4 billion shortfall in health care. No wonder they're trying to run from this state. Governor Perry decided to run for president. Dewhurst wants to run the United States Senate, get as far away from these problems as they can, because they haven't solved a single problem in this state over the last decade. That's their record. My record, on the other hand, when I left as chairman of public education, oh, and by the way, they also had 5 lawsuits filed against them for school finance. When I left in 2002, as chairman of public education, we had no lawsuits. We had the most equitable school funding system in the country. I'd given 3 teacher pay raises. I passed health insurance for teachers. We had a balanced budget with a surplus. My job is to solve problems, and I worked with a Republican governor and a Republican Senate and was able to do that as a Democrat. When you compare those 2 records, I think it becomes clear who you can trust in the United States Senate. And I think people in Texas are independent enough to look at that and know how they need to vote. And I think they'll vote for a Democrat. I do.
You know, Texas is an expensive state to run a statewide election, and it takes upwards of $10 million. Now, I don't know what your fundraising plan is, but how do you plan to get your message out, you know, in the absence of having enough money to, you know, blanket the airwaves with on TV with ads?
Well, I think you have to raise the money to get on TV. I don't think there's an option, really. I think if you want to win, you better raise the money. I mean, we're gonna have a great ground game, don't get me wrong, and get out the vote campaign. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to compete and you want to win, you're going to have to raise the money, and I know that.
Okay.
So here we go. You want to say, if you say it's $10 million, let's use that figure just for fun. Why not? $10 million means 4,000 people have to max out their contributions of $2,500. Or 1 million people have to give $10. Or 500,000 people have to give $20. You get the idea? It's a massive campaign. It takes a long time. It takes many hours in the day to raise money. But people of Texas can make a choice. You either want an election where you have a free choice to make, and if you do, they've got to donate. If not, David Dewhurst can write himself a check for $30 million and he can buy the United States Senate seat. And you can get more of the failed policy and disaster that we've had over the last decade. you can get one more voice in the United States Senate that will pair the party line, stand up and read the press releases, or you can send somebody that actually solved problems in the past. I hope and I believe that the people of Texas will donate and they will contribute to this campaign. I hope they will.
If President Obama calls you up tomorrow and says, I'd like to come down to Texas and campaign with you, what do you say to him?
Please come. Come on. Please do.
Okay.
He's President of the United States. When George W. Bush was President of the United States, I considered him a friend, too. I have great respect for the honor and the dignity of that office. I don't always and will not always agree with him. He will not always agree with me, but I will always treat it respectfully. I will always treat it with dignity, and I would always welcome his help and support. This idea or notion that a Democratic candidate can run from a Democratic president is ridiculous, or that a Republican governor shouldn't meet and greet and show respect to a Democratic president is obscene. We were all raised better than that. We were raised by our parents to treat people respectfully and with dignity, and we should. And so I would welcome him here. Like I said, we won't always agree, but I will always be respectful and I will treat that office with dignity.
And you have, so far, three opponents in the primary. When we finally have a primary date, we may have another filing period and more people may get in. I don't know. But when people go to vote in this primary, whenever it is, why should they vote to make you the Democratic nominee for Senate from Texas and not one of your opponents?
Because I have a record of solving problems. You know, I only asked for one thing when I served in the legislature. I asked the speaker, give me your hardest, most difficult, most complex problem. Let me work on it. And Speaker Laney was kind enough to do that for me every session. And we succeeded every session because I know, and I learned a long time ago, that great ideas can come from anywhere. They can come from your most conservative Democrat to your most liberal Republican. They can come from anywhere, if you will. Define the problem you're trying to solve and seek an honest solution for it. We can find answers to our problems. And that's the kind of work ethic I bring. It's my history. It's my record. And I'm very proud of the fact that the most often comment whenever I announced from people down here in Austin that was made in the media was, he's fair. I can't ask for more than that. I will listen fairly. I will try to decide the issues fairly. And do what's best for Texas and our country. And that's what I can promise, and that's what I've done. That's what my record is. No one else in the primary has a record that you can look at. No one else has served. So I think that's why I'm the best candidate in the Democratic primary, and I think I'm the best candidate in the general election.
Okay, Paul Sadler, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you.